It's time to get groovy. So let's smoke some weed and watch a movie. It's Highly Regarded with your host, Robin Luce. Hi, Robin.
Hello and welcome to Highly Regarded, the only podcast brought to you by the cool cousin that you'll be taking a walk with before dinner this Thanksgiving. Our guest is the second American woman to climb Mount Everest, a member of the first women's rugby team in England, a two-time round the world traveler, former restaurant owner, former Disney employee, and birth giver to the greatest podcast host of our generation besides Joe Rogan, my mother, Peggy Luce.
Who remembers the second woman? Nobody remembers the second woman.
The second
woman.
American woman, America.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Thank you for being on.
I know. And all the mothers out there who are horrified that I'm smoking pot with my daughter. I guess I shouldn't tell them about when I taught you how to make martinis when you were seven because Santa hated cookies and milk. Was that bad too?
Sorry, you're just fucking cooler. It's not your problem. I turned out sick as fuck. I'm grown. You're sick as fuck.
Thank you.
So, you know,
yeah,
that's on them to judge.
That's on them
to judge. And I now make a fantastic martini, so that's on them.
You do. You make an excellent, excellent martini.
You literally straight up. To be fair, I was eight. I wasn't seven.
Okay.
Because it was fourth grade. So I was eight or nine.
Okay, there. It's not so bad.
And you literally...
And it wasn't like I had you drink the martini.
Yeah, I just made them.
You just made them. You made a damn good one.
That was kind of my first hint that Santa wasn't real, is I was like...
At eight?
Literally, at like nine.
You just loved keeping that going, though.
Interesting.
You knew the truth much earlier, but you just didn't give into it, because, like, you love that magic. I'm not... I refuse to believe there is no Santa.
I've never heard this martini thing before. Yeah. I've never read that in one of the books. And speaking of the holidays, happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving to you and to all those women who are working all day long. It is a... woman's working holiday.
Yes, it is.
Fuck Thanksgiving.
Yeah, for real. And, you know, it's also a settler's holiday and blah, 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 blah. There's a lot of reasons we could say fuck Thanksgiving, but I can think of two we shouldn't. One is the opportunity to be grateful.
That's
and
true.
And two is stuffing. Stuffing smacks.
Yes, that's true. But it's just so much work.
Yeah.
But it is great to get together with family. It is awesome. I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I just like the being thankful part of it, you know.
Yeah,
like it's cool.
Yeah.
What are you thankful for this year, Mom?
You know, I actually am thankful that we had such really great time together this year because of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, it really was.
Our quarantine was.
Yeah, we were pretty much quarantined together, which I really loved. It was really a special time. So, yeah, I'm thankful for that. And Joe Biden.
Shout out, Joe.
Yeah.
Never thought I'd...
How about you?
Never thought I'd say that. This, I am thankful for good weed at a reasonable price. I'm thankful for movies and film and television and all forms of art that have got us through this time of quarantine.
Can
and
I change
and
my
boredom.
Answer now because mine really sucks.
Yeah, go for
yours.
It.
Yeah.
Should we like edit over it? But
no.
Let's use Tim's voice. Let's edit over it.
No,
so
that's
it's like,
okay. Hey, those were honest. Yeah. So we gotta own it.
No, let's do it. So you're like, I'm thankful for, and then it's just Tim being like, my family.
I love that. That's perfect. Okay.
We're sipping on some wine.
Getting the cotton mouth going there.
Yeah, because we did already.
Yeah.
Already smoke.
Yeah. So.
Well, I wasn't done with what I'm thinking.
I really liked your answer. That's
Thank
why
you.
I was saying it.
Because I'm also, I'm obviously very thankful for this podcast.
This is
and
a super
all
exciting
of my
year for you.
Amazing listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're doing it. I love that. You're going for it.
Thank
it's
you.
Fantastic.
And I'm very happy to go for it. And so I'm thankful.
I am super excited.
I am most thankful for all of you, our dear listeners.
Yeah.
But also the good weed thing at a reasonable price, that as well. That's pretty good.
It's so wonderful because, you know, the weed I had back in the 70s was like, man, you know, you'd get a sandwich baggie full of flake and it was like $10 for a lid. And you just had to smoke the whole damn baggie full because it was just like So not very good weed. And then I remember when like Maui Wowie first started coming out, and that was like, oh my God, okay.
How old were you when you first learned like the difference between sativa and indica? When were the first time those words were thrown at you?
I was 52, I think. No, seriously. When did weed get legalized in Washington State? How long ago?
I don't know. Hold on. Siri, when was weed legalized in Washington State?
I find this on the web.
In 2012.
Oh, my God.
So 8 years ago.
Okay, so it was 8 years ago. And so a dear friend and I, we were so excited because we could for the first time go and buy legal weed. And, you know, in my day, you didn't get to ask. You just were so thrilled to know somebody who... So
had
you
weed.
Never, yeah. Right. So you never got to say, you know, what is it?
What kind just of like, high
oh,
is
thank
this?
God.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we're running across this major street in Seattle, running to the pot shop, and we're against the light, and we start laughing because we're like, here are the PTA moms getting struck by cars as they're running to
the pot
store. So we get in and the people come up and they're like, oh, so have you smoked before? And we're like trying to be like, cool. Oh, honey, we invented it.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah,
oh, sweetie,
please,
how we smoked.
Know?
Yeah.
She goes, well, would you rather have a sativa or an indica? And we just looked at each other like, there's names? Like, what? What is that? And so
are we still talking about weed?
Yeah. So we were just, man, we went to school that day, that's for sure. But still, the whole time, it was so cool to think you could legally go in. I truly never thought it would happen in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So I was thrilled.
Let alone, I can't believe, you know, five states just passed legalizing weed in some way or another on, like, the same day. And fucking Mississippi legalized medical marijuana.
Wow.
Did you ever think you'd see the day
no.
where Mississippi was like, smoke it up.
Oh,
let
my
me
God.
Light the bowl for you.
Oh, the enlightenment is beginning.
Right?
Is beginning.
And South Dakota was the first state to legalize recreational and medical marijuana on the same day. So congrats, South Dakota.
Hey, we're making progress. So,
exactly.
Yeah, I know. It's like, chill, people. They just, it's not heroin.
Whenever people, like, are uptight about weed, I'm like, you need to smoke some weed.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to chill the fuck out.
I always say, you know, honestly, if you're going to get in a head-on car accident, I'd much rather get a head-on car accident with someone who's high, because they're only going 15 miles an hour, whereas the person who's drunk's going 100, so I'll take the high guy.
I love how that's where your mind goes, too. You're like...
Well, that's true.
Not like, who I'd rather watch babysitting my kids. It's like, you're going down I-5. Someone's going the wrong way. It's you or him. You're making eye contact.
Who would you rather?
Are they vomiting on themselves or are they bloodshot eyes?
What would you rather?
Someone's going down.
And your point is?
Yeah, he's like, that's what I love about you.
Yeah.
That's why I'm glad you raised me.
Thank you.
Yes.
Cheers.
Cheers. So you grew up in Washington, but, you know.
Most of the time, because I moved a lot when I was a kid. So we did move to Nevada. I lived in Las Vegas. Actually, when I went to school, I never went to the same school twice, 2 years in a row. And several times I went to like the third grade in three different schools.
Yeah.
So I moved all the time. So, yeah.
And you were the youngest of six.
And my mom grew up on a cattle ranch during the Depression. And then was a World War II Army nurse. So that woman was like tough as nails. She was incredible. She was awesome. She was such a she-bear. So, you know, it was kind of like being six. You never got, you know, her attention. So if you were, and then if you did get her attention, like if you were sick or complaining, it was like, you know, quit complaining.
Yeah.
You know, and we used to, every pet came with the tagline, I won't hesitate to put it down. I mean, seriously.
Charming. Yeah,
I said it. It was like, oh, it was almost like, don't get attached.
Yeah.
Yes, you can have this pet, but don't get attached.
But, you know, know what's coming down the pike. Yeah.
So, yeah, but she came from a line of pioneering women. My mom's maiden name was Callaway. And there was a saying, it was better to be a Callaway than to marry one, because we were very strong.
Did somebody tell Dad that on your wedding day?
Yeah, my mom's cousin went up to him and said, well, you did it. And he kind of laughed and he goes, no, Mike, you did it. He goes, you married a Callaway woman. And then that's when he said, it's better to be a Callaway
than to marry one. Yep. Love that for us.
Well, as I'm going through a divorce.
Divorce, yeah, I was going to say. And this year.
So, what do I know?
I mean, he lasted 31 years.
That's
so
true.
That's
true.
That's a good ride.
Yeah. It was a good ride.
You were always, like, a little different from your siblings, though. You always had, like...
Oh, yeah. I was so independent, you know, from... I can remember going to my grandfather's cattle ranch and being on a horse, and they kept leading the horse around, and I was just furious because I wanted to ride it by myself, you know, at five. I'm like, I can do it, you know, stop. You know, so I was one of those kids. Well, actually, another funny story. My older brother is... quite a pacifist. He's an awesome guy. So when he was a kid, he's 3 years older than me, he had a paper route. And so the neighborhood kids would bully him and take his papers and throw them on the ground. So he would bring me along and I'd beat the kids up.
Yeah.
So I was his
you were the
bodyguard.
I love the little sister was the one
who's like 5 years old, I'm beating the kids
up. Go and get him.
Yeah. So
I love that.
So I've always been a...
So you've always like followed your...
Absolutely. Listened to
own
my own my own rhythm. Then I was a bicycle messenger.
Oh, yeah. So then you're a bicycle messenger.
So I was a bicycle messenger in Seattle. And at that time, I had started climbing. And so I used to help out. There was a climbing store that I had friends at. And at that time, so this was 1988, really 1987, there wasn't an American woman that had been on Everest yet. So I didn't realize it at the time, but there was a group from the Northwest called the Northwest Everest Expedition. And this is the days before it was guided. So you had to get a permit, and in order to climb at that time, you had to get sponsorship. So they were going to the sponsors. The sponsors were like, well, you only have one woman, so you need to get more women on board, or we're not going to give you money for the expedition. So one of the expedition members went to a climbing store and said, hey, we need a woman strong enough to make it up Mount Everest. Do you know somebody? And they're like, oh, yeah, Peggy. So I'm literally sitting at home with a friend watching TV, and I get a phone call that's like, hi, do you want to climb Mount Everest? Oh, yeah, actually, I do. I mean, that was the boiled down version, but it basically
came down to that.
So,
how much time was there between you getting the call saying yes to the day you're flying out to get ready to climb?
It was probably about 7 months.
Okay.
But, you know, most you have to understand, most of these, this was already had been in the works for about 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, trying to get the people and getting sponsorship. So that was the other thing. Once I jumped on, then we had to get sponsorships and try and get money. And then my days were filled with working, and then the nights were, you know, writing letters and, you know, just...
Yeah, trying to do what you can.
Selling T-shirts, doing whatever we could to do. So, yeah.
Where did you guys, like, start out? Like, you're flying from Seattle. Where are you flying to?
We went to Kathmandu.
Okay.
And then from Kathmandu, we had 14 tons of equipment we had to carry up to the mountain.
Jesus
so
Christ.
I know. So we had shipped everything, like, 3 months before. So we were waiting for the shipment to come in. And the houses in Nepal, which, by the way, oh, my God, I love Nepal. Anybody out there, if you can get a chance, go. It's an amazing, amazing country. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful. So anyways, what was so funny is we had to rent a house, an empty house, because for 14 tons of equipment, we had, you know, hundreds of cases and ladders and all this stuff that was coming in that we then had to carry to a house and then start going through it.
Yeah.
We had so much equipment that the floors were bowing, like the floors couldn't
Jesus.
Handle the weight of all of our equipment. So so then from Kathmandu, we put all of our stuff into trucks, and we drove up to a town called Jiri. And in Jiri, it was now monsoon time, so we're going in July, mm-hmm. so we can't fly into base camp.
Yeah.
Because we had 14 tons of equipment, we had to hire people to carry it all, so we hired over 250 people just to carry all of that equipment.
Jeez.
Plus, we had 30 Sherpas. So from Jiri, that's where we had to have food, we had to have fuel, you know, you have to just carry everything in. We were in Jiri, and then we had to hike 130 miles into base camp. And then that took us 3 weeks with 250 people. And it was crazy because it's like, if we're in camp, by the time the first person left, the last person to go through, it'd be like 2 hours later.
So you're in a group of 250 people. How many of those would you say you can communicate with? Like, how many speak English?
None. But there was...
So that's 250 isn't including your trekking team. That's right. Just the group
taking. And we also had, did we have 25 Sherpa? So the Sherpa could speak English. So I could converse with some of the locals, but most of the time you couldn't. And, oh my God, it was incredible. For the 3 weeks it took them to go up to base camp, they got paid $3 a day. They had to carry 66 pounds. Every box weighed 66 pounds. And they got $3 a day to carry 66 pounds all day. Now, if they wanted to get paid double, then they would carry 120? Yeah, or whatever the math is.
130.
Don't judge us. I moved a lot as a kid.
132.
Then they'd get $6 a day. Mm-hmm. In that 3 weeks, at $3 a day, they would make as much as they would for the rest of the year. That's how poor Nepal is.
Wow.
So in 3 weeks, they could make a year's wage just by carrying these boxes. Amazing, amazing people, and so poor. And so my tent was next to the medical tent one night, and I'm listening. And that was one of the things that was really great for these people, is that it might be the first time that they could get access to doctors for like months or years. So I was listening to these stories just one after another. One guy had an infection so bad that they needed to open up his foot, but because he's barefoot, you know, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
I was on the trail one day, went next to a doctor, and this woman came up, and she was pleading with him. And he said, I said, what happened? And he goes, oh, she has an infection in her hand. And I said, I told her to go to the hospital right away. And then he looked at me and said, she'll be dead in 3 days. And, you know, so you're just this surrounded by these amazing, wonderful people who are so incredibly poor. And it just, you know.
Really puts into perspective, you know, I'm sure.
It breaks
Coming
your heart.
Home.
And at the same time, you're just the courage you see. Is this the reality that I thought I was missing?
Yeah, you know? This is.
It's like, oh,
exactly.
My God. I mean, unplugged.
Yeah, like, is this reality? Or
exactly. Yeah. It was a game changer.
Are we the ones living in, like,
absolutely.
A different world?
Absolutely. You just come back. And that's what I love about traveling is, you know, it's like looking out the window and noticing that there's a world out there.
So how long did it take you to climb the mountain?
We were on the mountain for about 3 months.
Wow.
So, yeah, and it took us about a month just to put the route in. So we had to bring in, that's why we had to go through what's called the ice fall. And when I climbed Mount Everest, 1 out of 3 people died going to the summit. Just in the ice fall alone, it was 1 out of 10, you know, would die. And the ice fall, think about it as like a waterfall of ice. What's so amazing is you don't think that ice moves that much, but it's incredible and drastic how much it moves and how fast. And so it really is something. You know, you could be standing there 1 second, and all of a sudden a slab of ice will just break off and you're dead. I mean, like, in an instant. So it's really difficult going through this, very dangerous going through this ice fall. And then because you have these huge crevasses opening up, you have to have ladders that you have to throw across them and then anchor them down. So there's all of this work that has to be done before you can actually, and then you have to establish camps. So what we do, they say you climb the mountain, the equivalent of climbing the mountain, I think it's 10 times because we go up and down so much.
Yeah.
So what you do, you go up and then work, go back down. Next day you go up to where you left off, go a little farther, come back down. The next day, you go where you went a little farther, come back. So you can understand how slow it's just.
So you're not straight shying up. You're coming up and down, up and down, up and down, up
and
down.
And then you get Camp 1 established.
Yeah.
So now all the equipment comes up to Camp 1. Now you have to do the same thing to go to Camp 2. So it's this, and you're at 18,000 feet. So people don't understand that. In altitude, the lack of oxygen, it's just incredible. Like, if I was putting on my clothes, my jacket, if I got my arm stuck, just straighten it out would leave me breathless.
So then, what was the closest you ever came to dying on Everest?
It was after I was coming down from the summit. So on my way up, I didn't realize it, but I had a faulty oxygen regulator. So it was on too high so that the extra oxygen was going out of my mask and it was fogging up my goggles so I couldn't see and forming ice blocks. Finally, I was getting so far behind from everybody because I couldn't see Because I'd have to take my goggles off and then take the gloves off, take the next layer of gloves off, take the next, you know, it's this huge process. Yeah. And then by the time I put them back on, they're foggy again. So even though I knew I was risking snow blindness, I thought, you know, I can't see now. I'm going to you know, take a chance. So I took my goggles off. So I get to the summit, but I'm behind everybody. So they're already, as I'm heading up, they're heading down and saying, you know, congratulations, you made it. And so I'm up on the summit by myself. And then when I come down, I notice I'm snow blindness. And I have snow blindness. And what snow blindness is that anything that's white is like looking into the sun. It's that painful. Like you can't make out depth perception. I mean, imagine staring at the sun for like hours. Mm-hmm. So what happened is by the time I got down, I asked one Sherpa to stay behind with me. His name was Dawa. Shout out to Dawa. And
shout out Dawa.
So he had blue boots on, and I could see the contrast between his blue boots and the snow. Mm-hmm. So I would have to bend way over to kind of try and see where he was stepping so that I knew where I could step. And my empty oxygen bottle shifted, and it sent me, you know, going head over heels down the South Summit slope, which is where Sharon Wood died. A lot of people die on this because it's a very steep slope. And as I'm falling, it was so weird because I always used to think that would be the worst thing is to fall to your death while climbing because you'd have all this time to think about it. And what was amazing was I wasn't scared at all. It was almost like I had left my body, like I was looking at myself as like a character in a TV show, like, oh, that's too bad. I liked her.
Exactly.
So, and it was really weird because I was thinking, oh, my mom's going to be upset. And as I'm falling, which I truly believe to my core that I'm dying, so much so that I've left my body.
Yeah.
And then just automatically, I just threw my hand, my ice axe out and grabbed hold and came to a stop. But and what was sad is there was another guy, I think 3 days behind after me, that fell in that same spot, and he fell like 700 feet and was really, you know, so I was, you know, pretty lucky that I stopped in time. But yeah, so that would be it.
So it gives you a pretty broad perspective on life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting because as I was starting to go down, I am so exhausted that I know, because I don't have oxygen and I can't see, I was literally, there's sections on the top part of Everett that are so steep, it's like a knife, and I knife it, or, you know, knife edge.
Yeah.
And it's the exposure that is so incredible, you can't catch on pictures. We're talking a 10,000 foot drop on one side and an 8,000 foot drop on the other side. It's not like, and so I was literally crawling on my hands and knees, feeling with my hands to make sure I was center, because I knew if I was just slightly off center, I would fall to my death.
Yeah.
And so I am just crawling back to, you know, Camp 4, just in this. I remember sitting there and thinking, if I don't get up, I'll die. I just knew it. And so this, but I also thought if I don't sit down, I'll die.
Yeah.
I was so exhausted. So I would sit down and then I'd be like, get up. Get up, get up, get up, get up. And then I'd have to get up and I'd take 5 steps and I'd have to sit down.
Yeah.
And then I'd be like, get up, get up. And it was just this constant, you know, where you're beyond the physical. It's a pure mental battle of, will I make myself do this?
Yeah.
Can I make myself do it? So yeah, it puts an incredible perspective on your life where you literally push yourself to the very edge.
Yeah. So when you're up, you know, climbing with a 10,000 drop and an 8,000 foot drop, for you personally, do you look down?
I do. But you know what's weird is you literally get to a point where you have to push the fear back to the back of your head because you know if you don't, you'll be paralyzed with fear.
Yeah.
It was that scary.
Yeah.
And that is probably the number one thing that I took off that mountain and used the rest of my life, where, you know, I'm the kind that will freak out over who took the last cookie, you know?
Yeah.
But, oh, the house is on fire. I'm chill.
Like, yeah,
I'm just
exactly.
Like, okay, what are we going to do first? You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's because I was so used to just pushing that fear out of your head and just like, can't do it, you know?
Yeah.
So that part was cool.
You've also traveled around the world twice.
Bicycled around the world. It took me almost 3 years. And that was the best time of my life. That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was really cool. So
what was your favorite country that you went to?
Oh, that's so hard to answer because there were some countries I liked because they were incredible to bike, like the Czech Republic. Norway was just the biggest bitch. We cycled the fjords, which I do not recommend to anybody to do, but it was just incredibly, stunningly beautiful. So Ireland is, oh man, it's so magical on its own. Yeah, it's so hard because it's they all for different reasons.
Exactly. And that is something the next episode you're on, I'm going to get into, because you have such an illustrious life and you are definitely going to be on this podcast more than once.
Oh, well, thank you.
Tune in for the next Peggy special to hear about the bike trip. Right now, you just got to hear a little
Everybody
bit
grab
about
your
Everest.
Wake up.
Exactly. Come on, people.
I do have a funny story about that, though, where I went to visit a friend that was on the expedition, and we were having Thanksgiving with him, so it's perfect that it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So he asked me if I would do a slideshow for, his mother was like in an old folks home, and would I be willing to do a slideshow for him? And I was like, oh yeah, sure, I'd love to. So I'm doing the slideshow, and after the slideshows, the lights come on, and every fucking person's like sound asleep. They're all like, with their heads all back and snoring. And he looks up and he goes, don't take it personally. It's past their bedtime.
And you're like,
but I was like, okay, sorry.
Thanks. Not a vote of confidence.
Exactly.
But I appreciate
I'm going to go out as a motivational speaker.
Yeah.
It's my calling.
Everyone's passed out.
What'd she say?
What? Thank you for sitting down for us for this lovely interview, Mom.
Well,
and
thank you.
You can't follow her on social media. She doesn't have social media. If you want to keep up with her, you're going to have to subscribe to our podcast. That's a great segue because our favorite thing on this podcast, the best segment, skip this segment if you're a shitty person. That's what we call it. And this is where we talk a little bit about the injustice with marijuana laws in our country.
Oh, touche.
We are here smoking legal weed that we bought in a pandemic that the government deemed essential. And in this very state, a prisoner by the name of Wei Long is incarcerated. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, his case. You tell me the sentence you would give him. I'll tell you the actual sentence. In 1975, he moved to the U.S. from Laos. He's of Chinese descent. He grew up in Iowa, but he decided to follow his dreams and his passion for music and move to California. So he ended up in Fresno, and in the early 90s, he ended up working on a marijuana farm. And keep in mind, we've been to Laos. Marijuana.
Best country ever.
It's amazing.
It's the people are phenomenal. It's just wonderful.
Marijuana plants grow on the side of the road.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal there. You know, he was working on this farm. Eventually, he gets out of the business. He's following his music passion still. He gets married. And in 1990, he has two beautiful twin boys. But in 1995, one of the co-operators of this marijuana farm gets arrested. And his pregnant wife gets arrested, too. So, according to Wei Long and his law team, a ton of the co-operators of this farm were offered lesser sentences if they testified against Wei Long.
Oh, you have got to be kidding.
So despite the fact that there was little physical evidence,
oh my God,
person after person got on the stand and testified that he had been at the head of this, even though it was a non-violent first-time offense and it was marijuana growing charges. Person to person came up on the stand and testified against him, and he went to prison in 1996 with his two 20-year-old boys, just 6 years old. He has been in there for a while now. His wife never remarried. She's still waiting for him.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
He believes, and as does his legal team, as does a lot of the internet and me as well, that being a long-haired Asian gave him a lot of bias and made him the target.
But still, that's, I mean, how can you turn on somebody like that?
In prison, he spends his mornings in the law library, where he helps others with their cases and works on his own appeal. In the afternoons, he still writes music, and he teaches guitar and music theory to the other inmates.
Wow, that's so cool.
Isn't that so cool? So he still makes a ton of effort.
And you know, that would be, you would have to do that. Otherwise, the despair, I think, would just, you know, kill you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, bravo for him.
Wei Long said that when he first moved to the U.S. in 1975, the only thing that was provided for him and his friends to do was a rec center that had no activities. It was just a place to hang out. So if he gets let out, his dream is to open a business manufacturing special instruments. And after school hours, he would have a free program where teenagers could come to the store and he would be teaching them music and manufacturing for anyone interested.
Wow.
And give them something to do in a place. He has been turned down for clemency.
Of course.
So with the information I've given you so far, how much time would you give him?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind was 10 years.
He was given 50 years.
Well, the first thing that came to my mind was 10 years in my basement.
Yeah. Yeah, why don't you grow there? Yeah.
Exactly. I'll give you a confined space.
I believe I couldn't find his exact birth date. I can estimate that he was at least in his mid-30s to early 40s, which 50 years is basically a life sentence. Then you're not getting out till your 80s or your 90s.
We just were listening to about the Wonderland murders.
Mm-hmm.
And what did the Nick guy get for being like a head?
Eddie Nash?
Yeah. Was like what? 1 year?
He served like 1 year.
Yeah.
And he was like one of the most notorious drug kingpins in
and
Los Angeles.
Killer.
And a murderer.
Yeah. And so this guy is getting 50 years for growing pot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's so sad is,
which is now an actual job.
Like, I was going to say 20 years later, he'd be like a legitimate business.
And the thing is we're not talking like Kentucky or Louisiana. He's in jail right now in the exact same state that we are in and bought, smoked 2 seconds ago. Weed we legally bought in this
state. I don't understand why every weed conviction should just end once it became legal. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, okay, you served your time while it was illegal. Now it's legal, so, you
exactly.
know.
The fact, I mean, it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
And then our justice system says there's overcrowding in the prisons, so we had to let
this rapist go.
Early.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. He can
commute
his time.
Well, I just was reading that today where in Kentucky, this guy just got convicted for child pornography again because he just got pardoned.
By the Republicans.
Exactly. So they let out a child molester who recommits. And this guy is sitting for 50 years for pot.
Being like, hey, I have a wife and kids, and I will literally do charity work if I get out of here. And they're like,
not only that, he's doing incredible work while he's in there. Too.
I
what
don't
a
know.
Stellar,
you yeah. have long hair. That looks sketchy.
You're an immigrant.
Yeah.
God.
You can Google the case. You can go to lifeforpot.com.
So what can we do?
You can read about him on lifeforpot.com, which, as I mentioned in the previous episode, is run by Beth Curtis, who is an absolute badass. There's a couple of different articles about him, and you can continue to donate and support to charities.
Okay.
All right. Now on to a lighter note. It's time to talk about the movie we are watching. It is Thanksgiving. Tis the season. We are getting into the wonderful world of holiday movies. And one of my personal favorite holiday movies centering around Thanksgiving with two of the greatest comedians known to man. Do you have any guesses as to what we're watching?
Well, is it The Ref, which is my absolute favorite holiday movie?
No, I know you love The Ref, but that's Christmas.
That's true. That's true.
We're talking Thanksgiving.
No, you have to surprise me.
It's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
John Candy and Steve Martin.
Yes.
Love that movie.
Trying to get home for dinner, as a lot of us are. Yep. This holiday classic has lasted the test of time. It's beloved by generations of people, old and young alike, and now stoners included.
Load a bowl.
Yes.
And away we go.
You want to watch the movie?
Absolutely.
You want to smoke some weed?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, then we will be right back. Gobble, gobble, and guess the fuck what? We are back. We're back.
We're back.
We're back.
Don't you love movies from the 80s?
I love a good 80s classic.
Oh, the music, that techno beat, and, you know, it's the hairdos, the,
oh, yeah,
the clothes. I love movies from the
80s. The cursing in a family movie. Oh, we
all
love
that
it.
Lovely eyeshadow. And yeah.
Yes. We have just returned from watching John Hughes' holiday classic, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Such a classic.
Yes. 1987. So let's see. You were...
almost 30.
You were 28?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you see this in theaters? Do you remember?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Wow.
I know. And I remember loving it. But, you know, it's such a, it's one of those classics that it always works.
It always does. You know, it's especially, I think, films that are rooted in chemistry between actors will always withhold the test of time, because what makes this movie so iconic is John Candy and Steve Martin's chemistry.
So
that's
well
like
together.
I mean, that's what it's known for.
Yeah.
And I think as long as you're basing loving a film off of that, that's always gonna hold up. Chemistry's always gonna be there.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that's it, just translates through time.
Oh,
and
I mean,
through
it just it has
so
all of the elements. You know, you've got the loneliness, the desperation, the need for family and holiday, and it's great. It just has it all.
And so, a little bit about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Obviously, it is starring comedy star Steve Martin and John Candy, made in 1987. It is written, produced, and directed by John Hughes. The film earned John Hughes critical accolades for the change in his target audience as angsty teens, his leads tending to be children. It was kind of his first film with adult leads. His previous films, Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, had all been teen leads, teen based. This was the first film he had made with adult leads. So he got a lot of accolades for that. Obviously, their chemistry. The film was highly reviewed by both Siskel and Ebert.
I love those guys.
Siskel cited it as John Candy's best role, and Roger Ebert put it in his collection of great movies.
Oh, great.
So it's gone down in history. Set DVD record sales, a holiday classic all around, remembered via generations, and it was a lot of fun to go back and watch. We can also expect a remake coming soon with Will Smith and Kevin Hart as leads. How do you feel about that? Will Smith and Kevin Hart replacing Steve Martin?
I don't know.
And
you know,
John Candy.
I don't know. I sometimes have problems with remakes. I find that most of the time I don't like the remakes as much as the original.
I agree.
Every once in a while, one will surprise me.
I kind of feel the same, Mike, especially because this is such an iconic film.
It is.
I feel like I'd love to see a Will Smith, Kevin Hart holiday movie.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that's that duo. I just don't feel like I need a remake of this movie.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like, we'll just let some things be.
Yeah. It also reminds me, too, of The Out-of-Towners with Jack Lemmon, and where he and his wife go to New York and, you know, the trip just disintegrates. And that's what I love about this movie is, like, who can't relate to trips that just fall to pieces or, you know,
traveling
and it just all goes to shit. So, God, that bit with the car is my absolute favorite.
That
whole thing of the when they turn to skeletons and then, you know, on fire, they're smoking.
But
radio
so,
works.
When we when we start this film, we meet Neil Page, Steve Martin's character, in New York. It's a couple days out from Thanksgiving, and he's trying to get back home to Chicago. And his cab is stolen by John Candy.
But not on purpose. John Candy's not aware that he's taking his
car.
Or do you think he was? Because all this time, it makes you wonder how much is he, you know, he is always having him pay for things. What do you think is, do you think that's deliberate or do you think he's really sort of naive?
I think that's probably more of an emphasis on kind of just like how annoying he is, like kind of trying to make them like, you know, like, I think the 80s especially like made their characters like really drastic, you know, it's like, like you look at it, Steve Martin's character is so uptight, but John Candy's character is like so annoying. But like every kind of movie character at that time, like, was that like they're just like it's that extremity of the time, like
the odd couple and all of that.
Well, not even just in this film, but in kind of all 80s.
No, that's what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
They had the TV show The Odd Couple where you have the really clean guy having to room with the really messy guy, but it's just that sort of dynamic. So,
that real harsh emphasis. You know, I love this film, but I really do struggle to watch this film just because, like, you and I are so the same, and, like, I just don't like lonely people. It makes me sad.
I know.
It's so hard to watch. And I really, you know me, I don't like conflict. I don't like people fighting. Like, people fighting through a movie is, like, kind of my worst nightmare. Yeah. Like, I love the end when they're friends and they make up.
I know.
And it's funny, but it makes me sad when they argue. I'm like, don't be mean to each other.
Well, especially once you know that his wife, in fact, can I do the spoiler alert? Do you think everybody
I mean,
knows
it's 1987. Come on, guys. Yeah. If I swear to God, if one fucking person's like, spoiler alert, are you kidding me?
Okay, so you know that his wife died 8 years
ago.
And then once you, you know, the first time you really don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
And then once you know, then it makes it so hard to watch it again because you're like, oh,
look
how
he's
sad
just so lonely.
And,
and like, delusional.
He has nowhere to go.
Exactly.
Oh, but oh, God. But oh, all the things that they get into. Just...
Yeah. So Steve Martin's character, he's on this flight, ended up seated next to this guy who had accidentally stolen his cab. And just talking throughout the whole flight, like, kind of our worst nightmare person to sit next to. And then they end up being flown to Wichita, Kansas, instead of Chicago due to an emergency storm. And then, kind of throughout the film, the two of them together have to kind of make their way through this insane route back to Chicago.
Because they get robbed and, you know, so they have less money.
And they literally go by... Planes, trains, and automobiles.
Oh, like I said, that whole scene with the car just cracks me up.
Oh, yeah.
From start to finish. I mean, first of all, when the type of car it is. And
they get this rental car together, and they're driving throughout the rest of this segment, and John Candy's character is smoking a cigarette and thinks he's tossing it out the window.
Goes into the back seat.
Smoldering. And then how is it that they get turned around on the freeway?
Because he gets hot and he wants to take his parka off.
Oh, God, that's right.
So he gets the cuff of his arm caught on the, you know, how the dial of your seat, which makes your seat go back and forth. Or
yeah.
Up, you know, so now he can't
use his left arm. It's
because
stuck
it's
in
pinned
there.
To the seat. So he's driving with just one hand. And then,
every time he tries to get it out, the car swerves a little bit.
Yeah.
And Steve Martin's asleep.
And then he eventually gets the other arm caught on.
Yeah.
So now he's pinned. Both arms are pinned to the sides of the seat. And he's trying to drive with his knees. And then that's when he misses the exit, barely makes the exit in time, and then they spin around.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that's why they go back up. Because they had done a tailspin.
Yeah.
They lost their sense of direction, so they actually went the wrong way on the freeway. They went back the way they came, and oh, God, that's so funny where the people, you know,
you're going the wrong way. How would they know where we're going? They're literally driving head first down the freeway. Yeah, but they know where we're going. And then they go right in between two trucks.
Oh, God, and it's hilarious where they're just, you know.
Their reactions. Yeah, it's just like flashing before their eyes. They're skeletons.
They turn into skeleton, then he turns into the devil.
John Candy's a devil. Yeah, exactly.
I love that scene. That cracks me up.
I know. So I do love this movie. Like, I love John Candy. I love Steve Martin, but it just makes me sad the whole time. Like, I don't want them to argue.
Exactly.
Like, be friends. Please, this could be good.
But like you said, they do become friends. And, oh, what an idyllic household. Holy cow. How,
right?
The brick two-story colonial.
John Hughes does love him some Chicago houses.
He loves that colonial style, doesn't
he?
It looked like exactly like the Home Alone house.
It did. I was like, honestly, is this the same?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Is that some sort of Easter egg? But no, it is not. And it's interesting because I just always think of this movie as a Christmas movie. Like, I always forget it's about Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I think it's probably because it's close to the holidays. So
and
it
has, like, snow in it. And we're always like, snow. Christmas
does touch the heart there at the end, and then makes it warms you with all the family love all about.
And nothing
but
like
it does.
A dead
I do like how it does make you really do appreciate, think about how thankful we are and appreciate what we have.
Yeah,
that is that reminder that there are people out there that are alone, and you know it just doesn't take much to just bring somebody home.
Just bring anybody home. And I love how, like, they always work in the gag of him being a shower curtain ring salesman.
I love like it when he's got the girls all wearing
them as earrings.
It makes you look like you're 18 or 19.
They're all handing over the cash. Yeah. And like, he has a connection everywhere at all these places. Yeah, I sold them to them.
Yeah, I love that. I love how he has friends wherever he goes.
Shower rings. Yeah, exactly.
I called my friend at Eastern Airlines, and yeah, he cracks me up.
Oh, God. And then there's that one part where they're staying at the motel after they've missed their flight, and they're about to go get a train. His friend's son comes to pick him up.
And he's tells his wife to go grab it,
and he's chewing tobacco and is like literally spitting up on himself, and they're just like stress smiling at him like, oh my god,
I forgot
about
what
does
Owen.
He go and tell his
and
wife
then he told, yeah something like scoot over or what do you think you're doing, get out here and
get out here and start lifting that trunk or something. And she's like a baby, and then
and she's like about 5 feet two or something
exactly, and then he says her first baby came out sideways, didn't scream or nothing. Some imagery, John.
The words you want to hear from your husband.
Exactly. Also, I like someone asked him how he's doing. He goes, "I'm still $1 million shy of being a millionaire," and I'm gonna start saying that.
Yeah, yeah. I love his character. John Candy's just what a shame he left us so early. He's such a great talent.
I know, such a
Uncle Buck, and I mean just. Everything he does.
And he's just
great.
So perfect in this role. Like, he just has that, like, distinct characteristic of, like, a warm heart. You know, like, you can, like, tell how kind he is. Like, only he can really pull off, like, this role. Because, like, you can really tell how, like, sweet of a person he is. And that kind of comes through in, like, a lot of his roles.
Yeah, it does.
Even that scene the first night when they're spending the night together in the hotel room, and he like really kind of snaps at him and like starts calling him
man,
a chatty Cathy.
That was wicked.
Really digging into him.
God, that was so cruel.
But then it's like John Candy's character just like comes back at it perfect. And he's like, if you want to hurt me, like, okay, but like, I like me and my wife likes me and my customers like me. And and that kind of, like, kindness and, like...
I know, yeah.
Self-assuredness, like...
Which makes him so endearing. It's almost an innocence.
Which I think will be interesting for the remake to see. Because, like, I like Kevin Hart, but he doesn't have that same, like, John Candy kindness, sweetness that I think this kind of, like, role needs. Because it's what, like, balances out the, like, uptightness of...
Yeah.
Steve Martin's character.
They might as well just do a different storyline. Yeah, just do kind of similar, but just make it your own story rather than...
Yeah, exactly.
Because I agree, that's part of the I don't know if charm's not the right word, but like I said, he's like innocent. You know?
Exactly.
There's this innocence about
him. It's like even though he's like annoying, like it's like he's... trying his best.
We all
best,
want to take
you know?
Care
exactly.
of him. You know, we all
exactly.
feel like, don't talk to him like
it's
that.
Like
he's so
protect
sweet.
Him. It's like, he's so kind. Don't do it. Don't hurt his feelings. things. Yeah,
I know. So yeah, so it'd be interesting. Don't talk to Kevin Hart that way.
Right? Exactly.
Even though he's a funny guy, I mean, it would be hilarious.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I think like they'll make a great comedy duo. Yeah. But I think there's so much heart in this movie that I think like they're not factoring for. But I could be wrong.
Yes,
maybe
there
they'll prove me wrong.
That's true. That's true.
Because, yeah, this is the, like, ugh, it's so sad when eventually they make his destination and Steve Martin's on his way back and he starts to, like, play back all the conversations and realizes in his mind that, like...
I haven't been home in years.
Years. That
yeah.
He
and
really
then he goes
learned.
Back and gets him. And
he's really just
I love how the lighting in the train station, because it even adds to the loneliness. You
exactly.
know, like there's nobody else in the
train station
but him with just a little soft light
like
coming
right
down
on
from
him.
The window.
And he's wearing his little like holiday sweater and he's just sitting there and he's
yeah.
like, what are you doing here, Dill? And he goes, I don't have a home. Which
yeah.
is like, and then he says,
and that's when Robin starts crying.
And that's, well, it got me left eye. Okay.
Oh, okay.
He says, I don't have a home. Left eye.
Mm-hmm.
Tear rolling down. Then he says,
that's right.
Marie's been dead eight years.
Both eyes.
That's when we got it. Yeah, that's when it got the double roll.
Well, there's just something wrong with you if you don't cry at that spot.
Oh, my God. Come on. Oof. Oh.
Who could not cry at that?
Come on! What are you, Stone? And then he has him over. I mean, also...
Carrying the trunk like they did the whole
time. I know,
way, yeah.
I love that he helps him carry the trunk. But Steve Martin's character in this movie is, like, really a savage. Like, he's straight up, like,
oh
so
my,
many times, like, I'd rather travel alone. Like, I'm
yeah.
gonna never...
Or how about when he goes up to the woman with the rental car?
Oh, the fucking... my God, that scene! We have to discuss this scene. That is... Eventually, they split off, and Steve Martin's supposed to get this rental car, and it's not there.
And he finally thinks he's away from him, so he's
like,
so smug and happy that, like, you know.
Score. And this, like, bus drops him off at this lot, and the car's not there.
That's, you know,
there.
Like 5 miles from the airport.
And then the bus just takes off without him. And he's, like, flipping out. The next we see him, he's, like, covered in dirt, having, like,
oh, yeah, because he rolls down and he slips
way.
In the snow. And
he slips in the snow.
And he has to walk across the runway.
And he gets to the front desk, and this woman's, like, not even looking at him. And I think, by the way, that actress who works at the front desk of the airline, I'm pretty sure she is the secretary in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh,
she's the one
yeah.
that goes like, oh, I've heard he's one righteous dude, you know?
That's right.
Like, it's her and she's talking on the phone.
I know.
He just looks at her and he's
oh,
like...
Oh, but her makeup, you know, with the blue eyeshadow. And
oh,
then she's
and the
talking about,
hair to Jesus.
And
yeah.
I love that she's discussing her Thanksgiving menu with Ambrosia.
Ambrosia. I love that. And he just
never, have you ever
so...
had Ambrosia?
No.
It's this weird salad that you make with marshmallows and mayonnaise. So you put in, like, fruit and coconut and marshmallows, and then you put... You know, some people probably even do, I don't think Cool Whip, but...
That needs to go to jail.
Mayonnaise. It's just
that
awful.
That needs to
I
go to jail.
I hated it. As a kid, I hated it.
That's
but
why?
But it's such a 50s, 60s, you know, Thanksgiving
why?
Menu.
Why? Who... I just would like to know, who thought of marshmallows and mayonnaise together?
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds like a dare. That
and
doesn't
coconut.
Sound like
don't
a
forget
dish.
The coconut. Oh, awful.
What the fuck, 60s and 70s?
Yeah, but they had a lot of good tater tot casseroles, so you can't
I'll
knock
give
it.
Them that. What's your favorite Thanksgiving side dish?
Ooh, you know, when I was a kid, it was the sweet potatoes. Oh, and then my mom would put the marshmallows on top so
yeah.
it would melt, and love those. And then when I got older, I kind of was like almost got too sweet or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's always bread. It's the rolls. It was always those pull-apart rolls. Oh, my
yeah.
God, I love those. With hot butter and jam. Mm.
What do you think John Candy's character's favorite Thanksgiving
Ambrosia.
Is? Yes, you're so right. John Candy's character,
loves
Del.
Ambrosia.
Ambrosia is his favorite dish. What about Steve Martin?
Oh, yeah. He'll probably be the French green beans with the cream of mushroom and the onions on top, don't you think?
I think he's too uptight for that. I think he likes white meat turkey. And I
probably just mashed potatoes and white mashed potatoes, right?
I think he likes meat. I think he likes turkey because he's a man.
I think
he likes gravy.
That we're talking about.
I mean, tis the season. It's a holiday.
That is. What was your favorite side dish for Thanksgiving?
I'm a stuffing person all the way.
Yeah.
Stuffing all day, every day. Or, a little bit of a meta answer, I'll say pre-meal cheese plate.
Ooh, always a good one.
That's also a favorite part of Thanksgiving.
And then, of course, the pies at the end, the dessert.
I mean, obviously, but that's...
goes without saying.
A previous year, one of my dear cousins, I won't cite her name in case she doesn't want this associated, but she took a shot of whiskey and then chased it with pie, a bite of pie, and it was the greatest thing I've ever seen. I've never seen
How old was she at the time, 14?
No, this was, yeah. She was like 22.
There's a pie bar in Seattle, in Ballard, where they serve whiskey and pie.
Yeah. What do you think Steve Martin's wife was doing all this time? Because, like...
You know, that...
How is she feeling? Because, like...
I don't like the way they kind of portrayed that either.
Sans 3 days. Yeah, they barely mentioned her.
And then every time they did, it's her in bed with the worried look and...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, in the kitchen with the worried
always
look.
Always in bed?
Yeah.
She is... Three kids, and she was constantly, like, in a satin nightgown, just, like, laying in bed, like, waiting by the phone. It's like,
yeah, but then they also have her, like, always worried and always, and then at the end, she, like, comes down the stairs as this confident goddess
this
of, you know.
Grand, yeah.
Of course I knew you'd make it.
Reunited.
I don't know. It was almost like they didn't know what to do with her character.
Yeah. Because they did nothing with her, so yeah. And then they kind of try to make it a thing at the end, and it's like, no. You established nothing beforehand.
Yeah. But then we have to realize that's how he saw her after realizing what he had and appreciating her.
He learned so much, and that's so nice, because at one point, John Candy, like, he's talking about his wife, and he's like, love isn't a big enough word for what I feel about her. And I'm like, is that real? Like,
it's only in the movies.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah.
Nobody says that stuff.
Yeah.
That's where they get us. Cause that's what every woman wants. That's what we're always holding out
exactly.
for. It's the carrot on the stick, and damn, we're always disappointed.
Like, I want somebody to, like, delusionally talk about me like I'm alive 8 years after I'm dead to a stranger, and then be like, actually, Robin's been dead 8 years, but I love her so much.
That's about all we can say on that movie. You know, it's a classic, but you kind of also go, not quite sure what you think to talk
about. I mean, it's pretty basic. Like, it's like... You could, if you had no idea, if you had been in a coma since 1986 and you watched this movie, you could pretty much guess everything that was going to happen next. You're like,
but still, pleasure
but
to watch.
Amazing, classic. I am very thankful it was made.
Yes.
And I'm very thankful for this amazing weed that I got to smoke, and I'm very thankful for my amazing mother being on my amazing podcast. So.
And I'm very thankful for my amazing daughter.
Thank you! And I'm very thankful for all of you rating and subscribing to this podcast and following us on Instagram at Highly Regarded Podcast, on Twitter at HR Regarded, going to our website, highlyregardedpodcast.com, and smoking some weed with your cool cousins, eating a bunch of stuffing, and staying tuned for more episodes every Friday. And we will see you next time.
Have a great holiday.
Happy Thanksgiving, mofos. Bye.